Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to begin our program today by talking with you about mussels in Wisconsin. Not the kind on your arms, the kind that are in the water. And, you know, we have a large number of them. North America has the highest diversity of freshwater mussels in the world. The Midwest historically has the largest number of species. But we have some species of mussels that are in danger. And we're going to be talking about the role of mussels in our environment, and we'll talk a little bit about those mussels that are officially endangered with two guests, both with me by phone today. Jill Utrup from the Wisconsin Ecological Services Office of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, one of our guests today. Jill, thanks for taking time to be with us.
Yeah, hi, Larry.
And Lisi Ketchel from the Bureau of Endangered Resources with our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, also our guest today. Lisi, got
hi
you there.
Yeah, hi there.
Great to have you. And you're at the Wetlands Conference. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago on the
show.
Yes,
I am. And one of the big symposiums here is wetland buffers, and that really helps with the water quality for these mussels. So it's great.
It's great to have both of you with us to talk about mussels. You know, I look at the steeple spectacle case and the sheep nose mussels, and they both look like clams to me, to be perfectly honest. And I'm sure there's some confusion about clams versus mussels. Lisi, would you care to talk about that?
Yeah, usually that's one of the first questions that I get asked when I do talks. The reason is people use the term mussels and clams interchangeably, and they can be. I mean, for vernacular reasons, for general use, I use them interchangeably as well, and our regulations are called clamming regulations because they were made back in the days of the commercial clammers. But technically, physiologically, taxonomically, there are differences. Our native mussels, a very key piece of them is that they require a fish host to complete their life cycle. That's really important. They also get very large. Our native clams are called pea clams. They're very small. You know, they're the size of peas. They're also called fingernail clams. So they're small, and they don't require that fish host to complete their life cycle. We do have one exotic clam called the Asiatic clam that gets up to about the size of a quarter. So if you've got something bigger than a quarter, you definitely have a native mussel.
All right. Well, let's talk about the importance of mussels in our environment before we get into talking about the species that are endangered or threatened in some way. Jill, you want to take a shot at that?
Sure. As far as their importance, in general, being filter feeders or
sure.
just being, okay. Well, actually, you know, mussels are pretty unique species. They're basically like indicator species in that, you know, they indicate the current condition of our environment or our rivers, really. You know, if they're not doing as well, it's kind of a good indication that their environments that they're in, their rivers are either being impacted by pollution or other effects as well. So they're really kind of almost like a canary in a coal mine, kind of a good indicator of the health of our river system. So.
And they actually filter junk out of our water, don't they?
They do. They do. Yes, they're good filter feeders in that way. And I don't know if Lisi, if you want to chat a little bit more about their siphoning kind of abilities, but.
Yeah, it's amazing amount of water that they filter through. They're really the filterers of our freshwater systems. And then when zebra mussels first came on, that was one of the problems, was they were taking all the nutrients out of the water. That's how efficient these guys are. Our native clams are in balance with the system, so they, you know, they filter the systems, and it's a great way to get rid of contaminants and other things that are in the water too. They're a great way to monitor if you do have contaminants in the water, and check over time and sample them over time and see what's happening with them as well.
How many, Lisi? How many types, native types of mussels live in Wisconsin?
We have 50 species, native species in Wisconsin.
Wow.
Yep.
And how many of these are officially endangered?
Well, 11 are endangered, which includes the two federally listed species, the two candidate species we're going to talk about today, and one proposed species. We have 7 that are threatened, and we have 8 that are special concern. So that's that's almost half of the species are listed as either threatened, endangered, or special concern.
I haven't given the number yet, so let me do that right now. If you'd like to join in, maybe you live near a place where freshwater mussels live, or maybe you've noticed a change in the populations in several years, or what about if you're a boater? Have you taken those precautions for preventing the spread of some mussels, like the zebra mussels, for example? We'd love to hear from you. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Well, I mentioned, before we go to the phones, I mentioned, Jill, the spectacle case and the sheep nose have been proposed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to receive endangered status. Can you talk about why?
Yeah, definitely. Well, both species are have declined significantly across their original range. For example, the sheep nose actually was found originally in 77 rivers and streams, but today it's only found in 24. And you know, they're found in this large river habitat, and within most of the sheep nose's range, that large river habitat has been impounded, often by dams, and so you know that leaves very short, kind of isolated patches of habitat between these dams, and that's a similar threat with the spectacle case as well. And with that species, there are it was historically known from about 44 streams in 15 states. It's now it's found in 19 streams in only 11 states. So you know, similar threats actually between the two species. Dams or impoundments really impede their movement through their. They actually depend on fish actually to be able to move. They're kind of unique in that they their larvae stage or glochidia mm-hmm. move on fish, and so these dams actually impede you know movement of the mussels between those dams or above or below the dams. Also, sedimentation, poor land use practices, dredging, those type of practices increase the amount of sedimentation, and that increased sedimentation can actually you know suffocate the mussels. Because obviously, you know, they're sedentary creatures. They can't
run away.
Avoid that impact. Exactly. So, and there's, you know, all kinds of other different, you know, pollution that, you know, these mussels are extremely susceptible to, again, since they are sedentary species. So,
well, they're remarkable looking species, and the names are perfect. A spectacle case looks like a spectacle case, and they get, what, up 9 inches long, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And the sheep nose looks like a sheep's nose. So they're remarkable looking looking creatures. Hey, Jill, is there any opposition to this proposal?
You know, not that we know of, Larry. You know, I guess in general, we would expect that people would be pretty supportive of this since, you know, they recognize the value of clean water and the importance for, you know, mussel species and other aquatic species, and in addition to, you know, human health and recreation. So yeah, we don't you know, really anticipate any opposition. So,
well, we have some callers online with questions. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or just go on the Facebook page to the Larry Mueller Show. You can drop a question in there as well. Jane in Middleton has a question or comment. Let's go there. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Larry. My question is, I have a pond in my backyard. It's about 1,000 to maybe 1,200 gallons, and I'm always interested to keep it natural. I just have goldfish in there now. I do not use chemicals on it, and it seems to have a good balance. If I could I add mussels to my pond to just make it that much more natural and the true environment?
Interesting. Jill, you comment?
You know, I might refer to Lisi.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, Lisi, go ahead.
Certainly mussels can be added to the pond. The limiting factor is the majority of our species prefer running water systems, especially the rare ones, which you wouldn't be adding anyway. So there's only a few species that do well in lake situations. There's one species called the floater. It's very thin-shelled, and you'll see it in a lot of lakes and ponds. It's a host fish, which is important because without the host fish, it can't complete its life cycle, are the minnows, the shiners, and carp. And so that's what makes it really quite abundant in our system. So that floater certainly is something you could put in a pond. You'd have to make sure you have an appropriate fish host. If not, you would, the mussels would survive to the end of their life. You know, and these guys are long-lived. They're 20, 30, 40 years old. So like a floater would easily live 20 years. So it would live there. It just might not be able to reproduce if you didn't have an appropriate fish.
Yeah. Well, goldfish is like a carp, I think.
You bet. It? Goldfish would work fine.
Okay. All right. And then I have a filter, you know, so there is some running water.
Oh, it's okay. The floaters can survive in running water systems. They don't have to have a lake. But many of the species can't. The running water is what brings them their oxygen and their food and gets rid of their waste. So some of them are just much more sensitive. The floaters are found in ponds and lakes and back sloughs. They also are found in streams and rivers. So they can survive in, you know, with some running water as well. That's not a problem.
Okay. Thanks, Jane, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Keith in Edgar next. Hi, Keith. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I guess you've answered my question, actually, while I was listening, and I was wondering how they get from place to place. We had we built a pond, and it had extensive bulldozing and redesigning of the water, the flow, and so forth. And very shortly thereafter, the outflow was lined from side to side and for a fair distance with I call them clams, but I guess they're really mussels. So since you've answered that question, I guess my other one is, how do I identify the different? Is there a book you can go to and look at the shells and figure out what you got?
Yeah. There's one book called The Freshwater Mussels of the Upper Mississippi River System, but that's comes out of the Illinois Natural History Survey. We also have a small booklet that I can just send to you that's called The Upper Mississippi River Mussel, and it's a booklet that has just a little one-page thing that gives you pictures of them and a short description. And you can also go, we have on our website in the Bureau of Endangered Resources, we have a website which lists the mussels, and then it gives you, again, a short paragraph and a picture so you could identify them. If you leave your name after the, with the, whomever,
with Judith,
yeah, then I can send you that booklet.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you guys can give me the website.
Yeah, I can do that.
What's the website?
Which website? For the endangered resources?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can just go to go to the DNR Endangered Resources, and I'm not sure. I think if you put in those, if you Google those, or if you just put in those, then that will get you to our website. We're right in the process of redesigning our website, so I'm not sure what the newest.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll put it up on my Facebook page, too, The Larry Mueller Show, so we'll get that for you. Keith, and I'll put you on hold.
Okay.
And let's see if I got you on hold. I've got him on hold. Okay. So we can, we'll deal with that. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Talking today about the mussels in Wisconsin with two guests, Jill Utrup with the Wisconsin Ecological Services Office of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Leslie Lisi from the Bureau of Endangered Resources of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Great to have both of them with us today. And they'll be with us for the next 25 minutes or so to talk with you about mussels and answer your questions. So join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our on-air producer and regular producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Monique wonders if many, this is from our Facebook page, are any of the mussels species in Wisconsin edible, Jill?
Edible. That's a very good question. I guess, you know, I don't know of any, but, you know, Lisa, you might know.
Lisa, do you know of any?
Well, certainly they can.
can be eaten, but I don't recommend it. As I said before, they're really good concentrators of any contaminants that are in the water. So unless you get them from pretty far upstream and you know there's nothing going in there, and we have a lot of cows on the landscape, I wouldn't suggest eating them. That said, there are, you know, some of those old river rats that will live along the Mississippi River, and they eat everything. So those guys, when they put them through a meat grinder, so you get this kind of extrudent, and then they either make fritters out of them or they put them into a chowder. But again, I'd be a little nervous about some of the contaminants that are in there. The Native Americans ate them literally by the ton. We find huge midden piles. It was very easy, I'm sure, for, you know, women and children to wade into these streams and gather tons of these guys. It looks like what they did was they smoked them in the fire. So they kind of made them into something like a jerky. They're very tough. I mean, that foot is a very tough thing. And so that's how it would appear that they, you know, they preserved them, and I'm sure in the middle of the winter, chewing on a clam, a smoked clam, wasn't such a bad thing.
Well, no, and probably there was less contamination in the water.
Yeah, I'm sure there wasn't any at that point in time.
Lisa Kitchell and Jill Utrep, our guests today, as we talk about mussels. Is there any comment period? We're right in the middle of the comment period right now, Jill, I think, on this proposal. Is it important for, I assume it's important for people to voice an opinion?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we'd especially be interested in any kind of information that folks would have that you know, that helps us understand, you know, not only the range of the species and the threats, you know, but also, you know, it really helps us, this kind of information to further assess whether listing of the species as endangered is warranted. So, yeah, so if anybody has any kind of additional information, you know, whether it be, you know, we're really looking for life history information, survey results, that kind of a thing. You know, that really does help us in this, you know, in making, and once we put all those comments together and are able to arrive at a decision. So, mm-hmm. and like you said, that, you know, that comment period is open until March 21st. So, and Larry, also, I can also send the link to that website if folks do have comments.
Excellent.
On your page as well.
So. Yeah, we'll put that link on our the Facebook page as well. Thank you for that.
Okay, great.
Daniel in Rice Lake, we turn to you next. Hi, Daniel. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I've wondered, when looking at mussel shells, is it possible to age them like the rings on trees? There appears to be concentric rings which show yearly growth, and what I believe, if I remember right, it's called the peristroikum.
Wow. Let's see. Who wants to take that one? Jill? Lisey?
I'll take it. Good observation. In fact, great observation. Yes, you can age them by the rings. And what happens is the mussels in the wintertime go down in the bottom of the rivers. They go down in the substrate, and at that time they quit growing. So that outer edge gets darkened, it kind of gets a little frayed. Then when they come up in the spring and start growing again, they put down new shell growth, and that new shell is cleaner and you know, tighter, and so there's a band that forms there. It's not, it's the same thing as happens with trees, where trees stop growing in the winter and they start growing in the spring. So it's the same thing that happens with the mussels. So you can do that. The problem, and it works really well when they're younger, the problem is as they get older, those bands get closer and closer and closer and closer, and it gets really hard to differentiate.
Sure.
However, these guys are very long-lived. I mean, we've had mussels documented 80 and 100 years old. So they do just keep growing. They just get so close, you can't really tell them. The way to tell them is they actually cross-section through them, and then the lines are more apparent. It's easier to see than from the outer edge of the shell, because the shell gets beat up a bit and eroded, and so it's not always easy to see. But especially when they're younger, it's really obvious what, the annuli that are down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matthew in Northwest Illinois has a comment or question. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm just a mile or two from the Wisconsin border in far Northwest Illinois, and we're fighting a large commercial dairy that wants to come, an industrial-scale dairy, that is building right next to a tributary to the Apple River. And we know that there's some of those slipper shell mussels in the river. I'm wondering how much pollution and contamination you see from these large industrial facilities and how they affect the mussels in Wisconsin.
Okay, well, let's see. Who wants to take that one? Lisa, you want to try that?
Sure. In theory, those large industrial dairy operations are supposed to be containing their runoff, and they're supposed to be, you know, according to their permits, they're not supposed to have excessive nutrients coming off the land into those streams. That said, we know that things happen, so it can be very detrimental to the mussel populations if there are big nutrient loadings, big sludges that come through the system, especially slipper shells. They're really a little tiny guy, so they can maybe kind of avoid it if it's not too much. If it puts too much nutrients in the water, you get big algal blooms. They can't keep up with that. The other important piece again is the fish, and so if the runoff from the land then causes the fish to stay away from that stream, that means that the mussels then won't be able to complete their life. They won't be able to reproduce. So yeah, it's important that you look at both aspects of it in terms of that water quality.
Harold in Waukesha County, on to you now. Hi, Harold.
Hi. We live in Golden Lake, and we have zebra mussels, which aren't too good. And they seem to be just sealing our, I call them lake clams. I don't know what they are. They get maybe 4 inches long. And they just seal them and annihilate them. The natural ones are just disappearing. Is there anything we can do to help them?
Lisa, you want to try that one?
That's exactly what they do. Unfortunately, the zebra mussels really attach to the all mussels, I should say, have an in-current and an ex-current siphon, which is how they suck in their water and their food and how they get rid of their wastes. And for some reason, zebra mussels seem to be really attracted to that place. Maybe it's because they're concentrating food, I don't know, but they start out at those siphons and then they just keep piling on and piling on and piling on, and it's just, they do kill the native mussels. They completely encrust them. They get to the point where the mussels can't open, and they've glued them, they're not trying to glue them shut, they're just attaching to the surface. It happens to be a live clam or mussel, and that's what they do. And when I'm diving, we often will pick up just a round ball of zebra mussels, and when you peel it open, it will either have a baby clam in there or it'll have a snail in there, the zebra mussels just keep piling on top of each other. So it's a really sad way, but that's what does in the native mussels from these zebra mussels.
Yeah.
Okay, we keep having the grandchildren remove them, but you can't keep up with them, you know?
That is exactly the best way to do it. Just keep stripping them off, and then hopefully the zebra mussels will crash and the native mussels will survive. We have had that happen in some places.
That's good to know. Jim in Fond du Lac, on to you. Hi, Jim.
Hi. The zebra mussel, of course, is the mussel that's probably most noticed in Wisconsin. They are phenomenal filter feeders, and I was wondering if any research is being done on lakes that have serious algal blooms, where they could take, if not a zebra mussel, some type of mussels, put them into a closed system where they could not reproduce, or at least the reproduction could not get back into a lake, and have a way to filter water through that system, let the mussels do their work on it, clean it out, and then put some back in. And I'm just interested in this. I've been thinking about it for a couple of months now, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Okay. Well, what do you think, Lisa?
Well, yes, I think it's a great idea, but many people have considered that as a great way to filter the system. And in Europe, where zebra mussels are everywhere, that's what they use in their sewage treatment plants. They don't bother with all this other filtering fall. They just put a whole bunch of zebra mussels in a thing, and they let them suck everything out of the water, and then they incinerate them. But we don't have them in all our water systems, and people are very concerned about the spread of them. And whether they can truly be contained is the biggest concern. And because these guys spit out these little veligers, which is what their babies are called, and they're very small, and they're very hard to filter out. And the fear would be that they,
would get loose, and then we'd be spreading them across the landscape. They're already, you know, on their own spreading across, well, I should say with human assistance, but they're already, you know, being spread, and so that would be the biggest concern. I think it's a good concept if we can just figure out a way to really, truly contain them.
Yeah, there you go. Bob in Madison, it's on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have taken a couple of trips up the Mississippi River years ago with some old river rats. And as we would go up north on south, we would see buildings, old buildings on the side of the river. And well, those are old button factories where they made buttons from the various clams and mussels. And they some were decorative, some were little functional buttons. Can you comment on that?
You got any of Lizzie? Do you know anything about that?
Oh, you bet. The pearl button industry was huge. And it was, and you can go to rivers all over Wisconsin, not just on the Mississippi, but when they took out the North Avenue Dam, there was a pearl button factory there, and all kinds of shells came out from that dam removal on the sugar, on the Wisconsin, all over the place. And they are just these small buildings. They had they had machines that could punch these blanks out, these holes. They were kind of like a die, a press, a punch. And they were everywhere, and clams were collected everywhere from through the 1880s up to the 1940s till plastic came on the scene. And then plastic was cheaper and easier, and they converted. But it was a huge industry. A lot of Wisconsin people were employed collecting clamshells for this purpose. And every once in a while, still run into old farmers who say when they were a boy that they would, on Sundays, they'd take a gunny sack down to the stream and they'd collect, a gunny sack worth of clams, and they'd even get a dollar for that. And they were thrilled. It was the only way they could get any money, being farm boys. But these button factories were huge, and the person that designed it was a German emigrant. He was a button maker, and he came to the States, and they hadn't been making buttons out of clams over there. They'd been making them out of bone and antler and other things. And he stepped on a particular clam called a heel splitter, and it's called that for a reason. He picked it up and looked at it and opened it up and saw the pearly nacre inside, which is that mother of pearl color. And he said, these would make beautiful buttons. And so he designed a way to make them. And the irony in his life is that's what made his millions. And at the end, he was, again, out fishing. He stepped on a clam, he got lockjaw, and he died.
So oh.
They made his millions, and it killed him.
Oh, what a story. Thanks, Bob, for calling. I'm glad to hear that story, although I'm sorry that it didn't turn out so well for him.
Yeah.
You can join in, by the way. We have open lines. We'll get you out pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or put a note up on the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'll get you on. We have a Facebook comment from Mary Beth, who says, so native populations are being replaced with mostly Asian, other species. At what point do we just stop fighting it, hand over the ecosystem to the new species? Ooh, what do you think about that, Jill?
well, actually, I guess, the thing is, those species are going to continue to, it's a never-ending battle, I guess, with these invasive species. But obviously we understand, and as Lacey and I have, chatted about as far as the significance of these native species and how they contribute to our environment as a whole. And, we're not going to stop fighting that battle, I guess. And we have made some significant progress, and I know Lacey can probably chat about, she's on a few different muscle recovery teams, but in terms of actually making some progress in getting some of our other endangered species, our Higgins eye, actually reintroduction efforts in some of our rivers. So there is, it seems kind of hopeless at times, but there is hope on the horizon, with some of these different projects that we have, getting these native species back. So.
Lizzie, you want to talk about some of those projects?
You bet. When zebra mussels came on the scene, there was a lot of concern of what are we going to do, especially in the Mississippi River, because they were spreading rapidly. And one of the things that was decided was
we need to look for waters where, you know, there are no zebes at this point in time. And then we need to start see how well, if we can propagate the species. And Higgins eye by far has responded incredibly well. We are able to propagate that species and put it out in rivers. We've extended the range in which it occurs. In places where it historically occurred, we've augmented populations as well. And it's just amazing the thousands of these just beautiful little clams that we're able to put out on the landscape. Genoa Fish Hatchery, which is a federal fish hatchery out of Genoa, Wisconsin, has been the primary producer of all these, and it worked well because they knew how to do fish, they knew how to do propagation, and it was a matter of just, we needed the fish component for the Higgins eye, so they made a building entitled the Clam Palace, and they've been propagating mussels in there ever since.
Oh, that's a great story. Meg in Stillwater, Minnesota, we turn to you now. Hi, Meg.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm looking at the St. Clair River right now, and I live in Stillwater. And I understand that there is a controversy about mussels on the St. Clair, and that there's a bridge planned to be built, but that whole project's been on hold because of the impact on the environment, and particularly the mussels. And I didn't know if you knew about that or if you could comment on that.
Have you heard about that, Lacey?
Yeah, I worked on it.
Okay, Lacey, go ahead.
It's a long-standing project. The reason that the first, we were almost to the point, let's back this up. They had done all of the proper environmental documents and all the analysis and everything, and at the last minute when we had gotten the go-ahead for the first Stillwater Bridge in this new climate, we had actually moved the mussels from the area where they would have been impacted by the piers of the river. We thought that the bridge would go forward, and then it got a stop action, and that was because of the National Scenic River considerations. And since then, they have been doing subsequent designs and redesigns and redesigns. I don't think the mussels are what are going to stop the bridge. It's more probably just the fact that it's a scenic river and they have to meet certain criteria for that, and then money. Money is a limiting factor. So I think that eventually it will move forward. But in the case of this, where there's only going to be maybe a couple piers in the water, we can move those mussels out of that way. That's not a problem.
So you can actually, how do you do that? Vacuum them up?
Yep. You dive and you go, you know, you mark out the area with a buffer and you dive it and you do it, you know, just keep diving until you remove the mussels. They did that for the I-94 bridge at Hudson. And you just keep moving them and moving them. We do it for other bridge projects throughout the state. You just keep going until you've moved them all.
So, but how do you pick them? You pick them up by hand?
Yep. You have a bag. You know, those are big rivers, so you're diving. So you're on the bottom and you have a bag and you just put the mussels in there and then you have a way to systematically go through that grid, and then you come back and you do it again, and you do as many passes as it takes till you don't have any mussels left.
You are a contact, for the mussel monitoring program that Wisconsin residents can help with. What is involved in that?
That's a new program we started a couple years ago. It became real apparent that there was no way with our limited staff that we could get out all over the state and look for everywhere mussels were. We haven't had a systematic survey back in the 70s by a fellow by the name of Harold Mathiak, but he wasn't a diver, so he only went to wadeable waters. But we do have a really good record of where he went and what he found. And what we're asking people to do is when you're out there, either in the river, the various river groups, the various water quality monitor people that we have out there on the landscape. We have trappers bringing us shells and nature centers and things like that. And what we're asking is go out to the rivers and collect the shells, not the live mussels. Just take pictures of them and put them back. But you can send us the dead shell, and then we get an idea of what's there. We give them the sites that were historically sampled. Yeah. So we knew what was there before. We can say what's hit there now. And then we encourage them to go to new sites if they wish to do so, just so we have an idea of what's in some of these streams. We have a lot of streams. We have no idea what's in there.
Well, actually, that's, well, this time of year it probably wouldn't be much fun, but
no.
But it sounds like something would be kind of interesting and fun. And how do people get involved in that?
It's easy to do. There's a citizen monitoring network, again, a website. It's one of those complicated websites I can give you, but
no, that's all right.
One. We'll have you post it. And they can go there. That will give them information about what streams we do have samples for. So it's a map that comes up by county and all the streams within those counties, streams that have been sampled and what's been found there. Sometimes it's streams that have just been undersampled as well. And then you see all the other streams that haven't been sampled. And they can just collect mussels. The thing that's great about collecting mussels is all you need is a pair of sneakers. You don't mind getting wet. You wade in the water. You collect the shell, wash off the dirt. You put them in a Ziploc. You put a label in there that says where they're from. And then you can send them back to me, to the Endangered Resources Program, mm-hmm. to Lisi Kitchell. And we identify them so that we know what they are. People are more than welcome to try, look through the books and try to identify them. We have trainings that we do offer, but it doesn't really require a lot of training. It's usually that we give them out that the mussel booklet is one of the key pieces. And the thing for collecting them is all you need is a bucket or an old potato bag, anything that, and what I use are laundry bags, because you just need something that you can have in the water and have them in the water, and then when you take them out, if you have live ones, you want to put them back. And then you've got the shell, and you put it in the Ziploc. That's not hard either.
No. Actually, and we've already, Judith's already put that up on our Facebook page, the post for that. So we have that as well. And anything else that we can do besides the monitoring to help preserve mussel habitats?
Yeah, I guess I could take a stab at that.
Yeah, go ahead, Jill.
Yeah, I guess it, just in general, just helping to improve your, to water quality in general in your local streams. Minimizing the use of lawn care chemicals, properly disposing of hazardous materials such as batteries, paint, car oil, pesticides, that type of thing. And also, in addition, as we've been talking a lot about zebra mussels, follow rules in terms of voting to prevent the spread of those zebra mussels and other exotics, that would be key. So, in addition to, conducting streamside projects, and finding other ways to avoid, increased siltation and sedimentation into the stream. So
there's lots we can do. Thank you both very much for being with us today. I think we have posted all of the various websites up on my Facebook page, so that'll be great for people to go and learn a little bit more. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Jill Utrup from the Wisconsin Ecological Services Office of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, one of our guests. The other, Lisi Kitchell from the Bureau of Endangered Resources of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Great to have them with us. And please do take a look. Go to the Facebook page. You'll find those various links, and I'll follow up if it's at all possible. Well, we're going from the water to the trees and the forest lands coming up next as we visit about a new book out. It's called One Family's Forest, and it's a book that can help you manage, if you have a little small woodlot or a big woodlot, can help you manage that woodlot. It's done in a very entertaining fashion as well. Coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.